Okay, so thank you very much to the organizers for giving me the chance to talk about my work here. Good timing, Sriram. I'm going to tell you about three systems. I'm an experimentalist, and so, well, two are the same system, living cell, eukaryotic cell, and the other one is an in vitro system. So with the first system, I'll just tell you about two different phases of the cell cycle, or two different states of the metabolic stream. And so I'll be including more of these students in the group. And the first part is a collaboration with Macintosh and the papers under the URLs now. It's on the archive, so you can find it here. And hopefully on the last part too, I'll be collaborating with Fauna. Okay, so this work falls in the general category of active motion and trying to determine it by looking at both the passive fluctuations and then driving the system in some way to look at the active part. And it's been very difficult in living systems to actually find ways to drive the system. Most measurements have been indirect, and you'll see that my measurements today are also indirect. But we're moving towards the goal of being able to do something like, this is some work from Christoph's group with two beads pushing on a cell. Ideally, we'd be able to do the same thing inside the cell and push on a nucleus, because I'll tell you about active motion inside the cell nucleus. The yeast nucleus is only a micron and a half across, so doing this sort of optical trapping type of experiment won't work in yeast. But maybe in eukaryotic cells or some other way to actively drive the system. So in general, the purpose of this is to identify what is the microscopic origin of the non-equilibrium motion in cells. And experimentally, it has been very challenging. And it has, non-equilibrium motion has been identified in nuclei, including in yeast nuclei and also in bacteria. And so these are some experiments from Julie Theriault's group from 2012, where they identified a certain time dependence of the mean squared displacements of the fluctuations, a power law dependence. And they changed the temperature and saw a specific temperature dependence of the magnitude while the power law stayed the same. And so they interpreted this with a fractional diffusion type of model. And they say that it's super diffusive rather than, super thermal. The temperature dependence is different than you would expect from Stokes-Einstein. So it is one interpretation of the physical character of the motion that you see in cells, but it's puzzling why it would be super thermal. And it can't be that the power law is the same as you would expect for a thermal. At least we don't think it could be the case. That's what they argue. So I'm going to show you data from my group on...
So are you going to tell us why you think it can't be?
Yes.
Okay.
I hope it's compelling. So I'm going to show you work done in my group using three-dimensional imaging using confocal microscopy. So we acquire stacks of images of cells, living cells, with, in this case, the data that I'm going to show you, there's only one fluorescent label, and it's on the spindle pole body, which is the same thing as a centrosome. It's a microtubule organizing center for the mitotic spindle. And so when the cell enters the mitosis, it creates a second one of these, and then the spindle self-assembles from the microtubule with the microtubules and the chromosomes present. And so you have a bipolar spindle. And if we have fluorescent labels on each of those two, those are protein complexes. So there's more than one protein. This is not single molecule by any means. Then we have two signals here. And as I mentioned, the nucleus is about a micron and a half across. So that's the size scale here. You're distinguishing two spots. So we do this in three dimensions and in time-lapse fashion so that we can extract the position of these spindle poles, which are a proxy for the entire spindle, in three dimensions and as a function of time. So the quantity that I'll show you is this metric, just the distance between those two objects in three dimensions. So it's just a scalar quantity. One of the advantages of this is that it's not going to be sensitive to any small stage drift, although of course we work hard to get rid of that. So it's, and if the whole nucleus rotates, it's also not sensitive to that. So you can distinguish fluctuations from rotations out of the plane, for example. So it's rotationally and translationally invariant.
But the z-resolution,
right. Actually, I'm going to talk about resolution because that's important, because that's what we work hardest at. So I do want to show you some measurements of accuracy so that you can know what is the error bar on the data. You don't need to know phases of the cell cycle, I think. Maybe a quick reminder. These are the phases of the cell cycle. They're not necessarily phases of matter, but the spindle does change, and especially in the activity, from metaphase to anaphase. And I'll come back to that point. This is a sort of generic mammalian cell where the green is the tubulin. These are microtubules or microtubule bundles in this organism. And then the purple is the genetic material. In yeast, the chromosomes don't condense to the same degree as they do in higher eukaryotes. So you don't have all the hierarchical condensation. You can't see the chromosomes under the microscope, for example. But you do have histones. So it's not just bare DNA in the nucleus. So I'm going to show you data from this phase, and we'll look at these two spots, and then secondly in the transition from this phase to this phase. So there's microtubules and motors driving the microtubules in the middle of this spindle. Actually, I have a cartoon of that here. So in a simplified picture, you can think of these are the two spots that we're imaging. In between, you have force dipoles. In the case of kinesin 5s, they're not very clear here on this, but they will tend to act in extensive fashion because kinesin 5s will move to the plus end. They're tetrameric, so they will bind to two antiparallel microtubules in the spindle midzone. Nature's contrived such that the microtubules are oriented antiparallel for the most part in this midzone. So those motors will tend to push the microtubules outward towards the poles, and therefore push the poles outward. But they can also, there's a restoring force, whatever is the viscoelastic material surrounding them, they're going to be dissipating energy into that material, or that material is going to be dissipating the energy. There's a second source of activity, a major source, which is intrinsic dynamics of the microtubules themselves. So you can have growth and shrinkage of the microtubules, which itself depends on GTP, not ATP, but these are both non-equilibrium force generation activities that use energy in the cell. Okay, the one movie, let's see if it transferred, that I wanted to show. It did not. That's okay. I just put the whole presentation on, and in Mac, you can't really see the individual files.
Well, PowerPoint doesn't
embed
the movies
in
Keynote.
Yeah, I usually use Keynote, but for the purposes of transfer, it's there. Yeah, maybe at the end there'll be time that I can transfer it quickly. So what you would see, and I'll show you trajectories projected into the plane for these two spots, but you'd see a lot of this, and then this, and we track that precisely. So that's one cell, but the way we do the experiment is to have multiple cells in the field of view, image them in parallel, so that when we analyze the data, we analyze it in parallel, and we get many cells, and then do a different field of view and do this multiple days, so we can really put together a population of cells. And from the data, we can segregate out those cells that are in mitosis from those that aren't, because they have two poles versus one. And then of that subset, we can segregate those that stay in metaphase during the observation window and those that go through anaphase, again, via the dynamics. This is not very clear also. I'm not sure everything transferred very well, but this would be the trajectory from the movie on the previous page. So here I'm highlighting just two cells, and the color coding in time is from blue to red. In this case, these two spots start out approximately one and a half, less than a micron, I guess, projected into the plane. And they stay at about the same distance and then move apart. In this case, they just each move around. If you were to look at any one spot, you might say that looks random. But if you look at the difference between those two spots, and for this cell and this cell, they're shown here in blue for this cell and in red for this cell. Yes?
And even if it stretches in one direction, it shrinks in the other one. Is it incompressible what's inside the nucleus?
Good question. It's viscoelastic. It's mostly the chromosomes. The whole nucleus is, I don't think we know if the volume is conserved. It does get squeezed. In fact, in yeast, it gets squeezed through this aperture in budding yeast to the, it's called the bud, from the mother cell to the bud.
The membrane never dissolves in
yeast. That's right. So,
right,
but it's not as stiff as the chromosomes. At least that's what Dennis Disher sees in his experiment.
The volume could be conserved.
Yes.
And these trajectories, they only kind of look a little bit clustered here because of the color scale. They're not clusters.
Clustered?
It looks like you've got a blue cluster, then a cyan cluster, then a yellow cluster, then a red cluster. From out here, anyway, it's fine.
No, time is progressing in this fashion.
I understand that, but it looks like...
Well, you can read it off here. So the dark blue goes up here. So there's no cluster. It must be just what's showing out brightest. Right. But there is. On this cell, it doesn't look like so much, but I'm going to come to that. We measure the fluctuations here. I thought that it was less than this, but it's coming out to be about the same. It's preliminary because I'm concerned that we might be getting too much of this in the phase. Okay, so this is what I'll show you is fluctuations in this quantity first in metaphase. So the thing sits there and does this, as you can see, and this is an observable. It's above the experimental resolution. So you see sort of 20 to 100 micron steps or jumps. These are real three-dimensional flex. Sorry, nanometer. Thank you.
Sorry, I missed one thing. The two spots that you're imaging are labeled. There's no beads here, right?
There are no beads.
Yeah. Right. Those two things you personally labeled.
That's correct. Yeah. No, I probably confused things with the picture at the beginning. So it really just, these are not beads. These are small. Approximately 100 nanometer size protein complexes. So what you see in the microscope is a diffraction limited spot coming from that. So I want to take a few minutes to just talk about the accuracy. So we measure the point spread function of the microscope, our optical system, so that you can really see what is the diffraction spreading that you get from a point or something smaller than the wave at the Rayleigh limit. So this is our point spread function in X and Y and in Z. I don't have axis labels on here, but it is approximately 1 micron full width half max in Z compared to less than 3/4 micron, approximately 0.5 micron in X and Y. So that's not the resolution of the position finding, though. The resolution of the position finding is how well can you locate the center of this. And that's what I want to talk about. So in order to determine that for our system, the first step was we measure the point spread function, and then we generate some points. Since we're looking at the mitotic spindle, we might as well generate 2 points that are separated by about the distance that we're looking at. We measure the background, the source of the noise in our system, again, by just turning the shutter off. So we measure the dark current, and then we measure the background in the cell. So we generate 2 spots, we diffract, we convolve them with what we know to be the point spread function of our system. I might as well show them these slides. Then we add on background noise. You can't really see it in this image, but the background noise is the noise in our system. So we sample from that. Pardon?
You have some fluorescent background noise.
Right. So the autofluorescence of the cell we also add. Then we measure the distribution of each of these. And the distribution of the background fluorescence in the cell is different from dark noise. So dark noise is exponentially, is Poisson distributed. And so we sample from that plus the background of the cell.
Do they have some dyes that are used also in the cell? Or?
There shouldn't be any dyes.
How do you label the spindle for 1 second?
Just with a fluorescent protein.
So that fluorescent protein is all at the spindle one? Or is it
yes.
Else?
No, it's only there. Yeah. But the cells do have a small amount of autofluorescence. You could probably see it in that picture that I showed before. this is sort of the outline of the cell. That's the bud, and that's the mother. So that gives you some idea. Okay. So we generate these spots, and then we run the feature finding blindly to locate the position of these with added background noise. And then we compare that to the known positions.
So is this simulation here?
The simulation is simply generate two spots with a known separation, make them look like the spots in our images, blindly run the three-dimensional Gaussian fitting. By blindly, I mean as if you didn't know the position of them, and compare that to the known position. And do that 500 times. So I'm calling it a simulation, but it's not like one of your simulations. It's just generating multiple iterations at one signal to noise, and then we do this for a range of signal to noise and make it small.
And the spots you generate are you set to be the known size of the object
yes.
you're tracking, then you could convolve.
Then we convolve with our known point spread function, then we add on the background noise of our system, right? Yeah, we think it's cool. So we did this as a function of various signal to noise. And I'm showing you here X and Y. They're basically identical in these two colors. And this is Z. Of course, Z is worse. So this is in nanometers. And this each spot here is the result from 500 iterations of that feature finding, with the first and third quartiles shown by the error bars. So you can easily get better than 5 nanometers. We do in X and in Y. And then a little worse than 10 nanometers in Z. So in three dimensions, you get something like 12 nanometers resolution. So I didn't talk about how we image the cells and why it's important how we image the cells. In this case, we're integrating for 60 milliseconds each plane. And then we collect 21 focal planes for each stack. And then we wait. So we wait 10 seconds. Well, that's not because we're hardware limited, but because if we image more frequently, then the cells undergo some photo damage and they actually won't divide. So we use the experiment, initially we use the experiment to tell us how we should do the imaging in such a way that they undergo their normal behavior. So the sampling rate that we use is a little bit conservative, but it's set by the cells and not by our hardware. And so that's going to show up in a few minutes. That limits us to low frequencies.
Are the fluorescent proteins continuously replenished by the cells, or is it like once per division they make them or something like that?
It's once per division they make them, but it's 80. So we did this in order to test. If we have photobleaching going on while we're imaging, then we're going to be moving down this. But it turns out that because we can't image very frequently, and we only do 20-minute time window so that we don't burn the cells, basically. No, we treat them very well. And so we're always up there. It turns out we don't need to worry about photobleaching because of the way we have to do the experiment. With colloids, you always had to worry about this. Yeah. So there was a question when Tommy was talking last week about the cell cycle, and what he sees for his cells is exactly what we see, and this is known by biologists. It's just a logistic curve. So probably you've heard of this logistic equation before for population growth. Basically, dn by dt is equal to just some intrinsic growth rate times the number of cells. This would be an exponential growth, and then you have 1 minus n over k, where k is some carrying capacity. So as the population starts to approach the carrying capacity, the growth saturates. So this curve looks like this. You start out with some population level. So when we grow cell cultures, this is something we can manipulate, and then at low density, the cells will grow without bound exponentially, and then they start to reach this carrying capacity. If you increase the nutrient concentration, you can move up or down this carrying capacity. So we measure this for every, we spend a lot of time calibrating this. So when we image the cells, we're down here. Oh, another thing I should say is that the cell cycle in yeast is 90 minutes. So we do some fraction of the cell cycle our cells are unsynchronized. So in that 20-minute window, some of them are in between anaphase and the next cell cycle. Some of them are in metaphase. And so it usually takes, depending on how you set the carrying capacity, it usually takes about 10 generations to reach this point. So we image down here. We bring the cells back down so that while we're imaging them, they're not getting stressed by the fact that they're running out of nutrients and competing for nutrients.
If you were to go further up into that time toward the carrying capacity, would you basically just suppress anaphase and you'd have longer metaphase periods?
Yes. They usually halt before entering. That's right. They just stay in metaphase.
But I would wonder if maybe the dynamics could be the same otherwise.
Oh, that could be interesting. And then we collect all the cells in metaphase. Well, I can tell you that why did we spend so much time figuring out, okay, we need to do 10 seconds? Because before we were imaging them as fast as we could, and we were never seeing cells go through anaphase while we were observing them. So you look at a population of 200 cells, in 20 minutes you should see some fraction of them go through anaphase, and we weren't seeing that. So then we changed the medium, we changed our imaging time, and so I think what you would see there is the cells would all stay in metaphase. But to answer your question, we did see the dynamics is different. They did fluctuate. We were measuring. We got lots of fluctuation. Less fluctuation, yeah, suppressed. So they probably aren't cycling ATP as quickly. Okay, so this is the size of our error bar, basically. And so when you come back to those fluctuations that I showed, it's much smaller than the size of the symbol here. So these are real, and it's fluctuating.
So, but you said you require data every 10 seconds. So there's this seems more than 10 seconds.
Or no, that's every 10 seconds. They're big.
But you could check experimentally how well you act. I mean, it might be more robust to check experimentally how. What is your accuracy, not to rely on theoretical models?
You can't measure the accuracy experimentally.
Well, you run into some flat white noise problem.
Yeah.
But you could just fix your cells.
But you can't fix the nucleus unless you take the nucleus out of the cell. It's still moving around in there.
Really, even if you fix the whole thing and.
If you fix the outside of the cell, you can't fix the nucleus unless you. But then you measure precision, not accuracy. You don't know the position of that thing. You just would say, I think there's no motion. That's precision. I'm just showing the accuracy here. There's no way to compare. We can talk about terminology, but there's no way to compare a known position in living cells.
The distance should stay constant between the two spots in the fixed cell.
We fixed. You can glue the cells down to the substrate, and they still fluctuate.
No. What I'm saying, you can permeabilize the cells, and you can fix the whole cytoskeleton, right?
You could. Yeah. I don't think we would learn any more than what we've already learned. We've spent.
Why do you need such an accuracy? Because you give the impression that you have a huge difference between the two. Why do you need 20 nanometers inside? Usually, people get 100 nanometers.
Because we want to be able to measure these small fluctuations. Who doesn't want to be 5 times better? Who doesn't want to be 5 times better? No, I take your point. Maybe we're working too hard to get something that's more broad. That's kind of our niche, I guess. Okay, so the fluctuations themselves, maybe we can talk some more about that afterwards, because we just haven't. Oh, the error bars are not showing either. Okay. Okay. So this is for a population of 30 different cells. It looks like this. So. Here the cells are identical, they're in the same nutrient concentration, they're in the same phase of the cell cycle, they're at the same temperature, we have a temperature stage on the microscope. And there are the subset of cells of hundreds that stay in metaphase, and for every time point we have two poles. Okay. So of that population, this is the power spectrum of the fluctuations. So we take that red curve that I showed on the previous slide and do the Fourier transform, measure the power spectrum of this. And this is the average over a population of cells. And the first and third quartiles are showing. Yeah, thanks for adjusting the contrast. So this is where I'm going to get to. It's different from what you would expect from thermal. So first of all, down here, it really looks like we see this power law minus 1.3. What does it mean? And then it does actually, it's not a true power law in this region. So I was thinking a lot about Fred and Alex's model that they have.
What do these error bars mean?
First and third quartile, in this case, of a population. So measuring the power spectrum is an intrinsically noisy thing. So one cell might do this, and another cell might do this. Yeah.
And for a server system, it could be.
Pardon me?
For a server computing system, the first part would be that?
No. No. The first part will be, as Fred said yesterday morning, there will be some color to the power spectrum depending on the response of the material. Oh, if it's purely elastic, yes, it would be flat. If it's purely viscous, it would have a 1 over omega dependence. If it's, sorry, for thermal, right. And if it's purely elastic,
basically, if you've got two objects bound, then you have a constant 1 over omega squared.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's not explained.
No. This is a force spectrum from a model that I'm going to talk about on the next slide.
But it's certainly going to be a viscoelastic media. Yeah. And so it's going to have
some color.
Significant frequency dependence.
Yeah.
Actually, you go in there?
Yeah.
At the end, you think it's noise when it gets flat? That's your.
We think it's real, and I'll show you why in a moment.
Do you block the power spectrum, because the power spectrum itself should have non-Gaussian.
Well, we do all the filtering that you do.
But you also block one, so.
Yeah.
It's like it's logarithmically
bin. Yes. Okay. It's logarithmically bin from, well, you can see from here onward.
Well, I think Krista was asking that if you ask for the statistics of a given point, does it have a lot of weight in the wing?
The statistics of a given point are here. So we know that we're not in the noise because the statistics, it's log normal everywhere for the whole spectrum. So this point here, I think, we're not showing everything on here. So there should be a pink faint line through here. So these are for 3 points across here. And the power across the cells is distributed at those frequencies according to this. So our noise floor is somewhere down here, and the Nyquist frequency is up here. So in order to interpret this, I was really thinking a lot about this model that Fred has with Alex, Fred McIntosh and Alex Levine have, that was developed not for the nucleus, but for cytoskeleton, or at least a model cytoskeleton with force generation in it. So cross-linked actin networks that are random, not anisotropic, with myosin minifilaments that can apply a force that has a characteristic coherence time, some processivity time. And so you should expect to have, the model is that each time a motor comes on, in this case it would be a contractile type force. If the filament network is cross-linked, the force is transduced out to the nearest cross-links. And this would be happening all over the place. So the model says, okay, let's imagine you have these forces all acting independently, and they have some characteristic time for coming on, and then what would be the force spectrum that you should get from that? And that is a Lorentzian. That's the force spectrum, not the fluctuation spectrum. So the really interesting thing was this omega to the minus 2 power law expected for the four spectrum when you have these active systems. So the idea is, in this this part of the frequency range, you're inside the coherence time of those motors. Down in this part of the frequency regime, you're beyond the coherence time of these motors. They've already acted, so you're basically in the dissipation part. So it predicts a white noise force spectrum down here. And for reasons I talked about earlier, the frequencies that we can access are low frequencies. And so in that case, you should expect that your fluctuation spectrum, which would be just the force spectrum divided by the square of the complex modulus, in that case, if this is white noise, then the fluctuation spectrum should just follow 1 over the square of the complex modulus. So we measured the, so this is all by, let me come back to, so if you had, I just have a slide here to sort of categorize what you'd see in those two different regimes and what you'd see in the time domain for the fluctuations and what you'd see in the frequency domain for the fluctuations. So, and I'm comparing to what you would expect for thermal by fluctuation dissipation theorem. So by active correlated, I mean beyond that crossover time where you would expect the force to go like 1 over omega squared. And for active uncorrelated, I mean in the white noise part of the force spectrum. So what you would expect here, I've plotted the power law for the force spectrum. For the, I'm going to work in the frequency domain. So the fluctuations in the power spectrum, what you should expect to see in the white noise regime is just omega to the minus 2 beta, where beta is, if you have a power law, viscoelastic response of your material. So this is just 1 over this squared.
Why do you have alpha and beta?
Well, because your viscous modulus is not the same power law as your complex modulus.
Including that rule, for example.
Right. So fluctuation dissipation theorem ties the fluctuations to the viscous response, whereas if your stresses are not viscous but instead are active stresses, you decouple that and it only then depends on the complex modulus. I thought I had. Yeah. So we built an in vitro system where we look at just bare DNA, chromosomal DNA, with at concentrations that mimic the concentration of the cell nucleus, have beads embedded in the material, and monitor the motions of the beads by microrheology. So we measure the response of the nuclear material this way. We also separately have fluorescent labels in the living cell around the nuclear envelope and looked at the fluctuations of that to see if that is actually what has the response, if that's dominating the response of the material. But it turns out to be, it looks like the chromosomes dominate the response. So this is the rheology that you see from this.
This is rheology of entangled DNA?
Yes.
With certain concentration.
That's right. That's right. At 1 mg/mL. And the time scales that we can access, only part of it overlaps with the frequencies of our experiment, the frequency regime of our experiment. So we do see this power, approximately this much overlaps with our experiment. And at the really low frequency regime, there is a power law for the complex modulus. I'm not showing the complex modulus here, but it has a certain power law that's 0.65.
Where is the activity coming from?
There's no activity here. So this would be, what's the linear response of the material?
This in hertz or radians per second?
This is in radians per second. So we see frequency at low frequencies, this power law, which would be exactly consistent with a white noise force spectrum if the fluctuations that we see are driven by motors or microtubule dynamics that have a coherence time shorter than the time scales that we're looking at and have this type of linear response. And beyond that power law, the low frequency power law, we take the entire region, which I've outlined in black here, that overlaps with our experiment, take the complex modulus, square it, and plot one over that, times some arbitrary multiplicative factor this way, and it goes right through the data. So that's another reason why I don't think that this is noise, although something could be setting in there, right? So this comes back to your question at the beginning, which was, what would thermal look like? So this is what you get from activity that's uncorrelated in that material. And what you would get for thermal from that material is this. This amplitude is real. This amplitude is arbitrary.
So you have more activity at high frequency? Well, it's not.
Well, it's not real in the sense that it's for that cell. It's real for the in vitro.
This and this are real with respect to one another, and they're multiplied by some arbitrary factor compared to the living cell.
With respect to each other, only if you assume that the in vitro experiment is giving you the right absolute magnitude.
But
I'm wondering if you can say that the thermal is so close to the active world, the vertical distance. Maybe
you don't have an independent way of knowing the relative amplitude of activity to thermal.
Right.
So what's driving this?
Well, that's a good question. Thank you, Swanamir. So in the next slide, I'll show you. Before I get to that, I just wanted to add, so this is what you would expect from fluctuation dissipation theorem in that material. But before we get to what's driving it, this power law that we see at low frequencies is exactly consistent with what Dennis Tischer has measured for the compliance of nuclei that resemble yeast nuclei. So this is an experiment that he's done where you actually interfere with the cytoskeleton, do the micropipette experiment where and you measure the compliance and look, and he sees power law behavior for the compliance. And so by interfering with the cytoskeleton, the nucleus then dominates the mechanics. And he also sees the same as we do, that the membrane and the nuclear membrane do not dominate the mechanics. So he does this in mammalian cells that have an extra thing that our yeast nuclei don't have, which is lamins. These are intermediate filaments, kind of like a cortex, but not for the cell, for the nucleus. So that makes it stiffer and like something plastic. So he sees a lower power law for those type of cells. Those are in black here. But for cells in which he's knocked out the lamins, or for stem cells which don't yet have lamins, he sees a power law that's exactly like what we see. And he also sees the DNA flow into the micropipette. So qualitatively, there's also reasons to back up the fact that the DNA is giving this power law. Okay, so we combine this high resolution 3D microscopy and tracking with two-point microarrayology to study the fluctuations in the eukaryotic cell nucleus. We observe these fluctuations quantitatively, and they're quantitatively consistent with uncorrelated force fluctuations. The time dependence that we do see, if you look in the time domain, is consistent with that data from bacteria from the Theriault group. But the implied force fluctuations are certainly not thermal. And it's consistent with a simple model of uncorrelated active fluctuations. By the way, this type of DNA rheology is also what you'd expect from the ZIM model for polymers in the entangled regime. Okay, so we then knocked out the two types of, so I showed this simplified picture here. One mechanism of force generation is if you have these dipolar forces acting on the microtubules via the kinesin 5s that have some characteristic processivity time. Yeast have two of these kinesin 5s. If you remove both of them, genetically the cells don't live. And so you can't do both of them at the same time, but you can genetically remove one or the other. and do the experiment in that way. So we've done that. This KIP1 and SYN8 are just the names of these two motors. So in blue is the data that I showed you before, wild type. In red is another population of cells that have had the gene for KIP1 completely deleted. And the green is cells that have had the gene for SYN8 completely deleted. So we see no difference in the fluctuations. If anything, the spindle is maybe a little bit less stiff, so the fluctuations are a little higher. But the power loss is the same, and it's the same as the DNA rheology. So it really looks like the motors in metaphase are not what's driving this, or all we can say is that turning down the number probably in the cell, even by deleting a gene, you can't be sure that you've turned down the number of kinesin 5s in the cell, because only a small number of them are actually active during metaphase anyway. It's really during anaphase that they kick in.
Are they inhibitors for kinesin 5?
There are not direct inhibitors for kinesin 5.
For X5 and so on, there are, but for these ones, I don't think they work.
So monostrol for fruit fly one. Well, I guess you could put in the fruit fly one and then add that drug.
But also the majority of the kinesin 5s are near the spindle folds. Only a small fraction.
In metaphase. Yeah.
All the time they're concentrated at the folds.
The Schreiber group has shown is that there are still high concentrations out here, but not the majority anymore in anaphase. If you integrate over this region, if you look, there are more kinesin 5s in the middle. Maybe there are these pools. Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Nobody talks about that. Everyone talks about the kinesin 5s are in here, but there are these. Christoph is talking about these two pools that you see if you fluorescently label the kinesin 5s. Are there any more questions on this? So we can't eliminate the motors as being what's driving it with this data. So neither of these, we can say, are solely responsible for the observed fluctuations. We did do ATP depletion as well, so you interfere with mitochondrial respiration as well as glycolysis, so ways the cell can make new ATP. But microtubule polymerization uses GTP, so there's no way to interfere directly with GTP. And in the yeast, if you interfere with ATP, it turns out that the ratio of the pools of ATP and GTP shift. So the cell actually has more GTP than ATP if you do that. So we can't directly target ATP, microtubule polymerization and depolymerization either. So I don't have the data on here, but when we do that interference with ATP generation in the cell, we also still see the same power law down here. That we haven't done. In vitro, you can stabilize microtubules with Taxol, but I don't know that you can do that in living cells. Well, so the way we do the experiment is you grow the cell culture overnight, and then we measure this curve, and then we dilute them back here. So if you were to add Taxol at any point, they simply would stop all the microtubule disassembly and assembly. So you'd have to do it right before the experiment. I've never seen people do that in yeast, so I'm not. I think if it was possible, it would have been done.
I'm not so sure if we'll pick up Taxol.
Which part of cell cycle is when you're in, but so transcription activity is not taking place at all?
There is some transcription activity. It could be the motors on the DNA, the various.
I would have thought that those could also contribute to active noise.
Absolutely. Yes?
There's a coupling to the cytoskeleton around it.
Yeah, there's a small number of astromicrotubules that extend all the way to the cell surface. By small, I mean two or three at most if you image a tubulin, if you label a tubulin. There's also Dynein motors on those microtubules, which are out at the cell cortex for the most part. And they are stabilizing the nucleus by keeping it under tension. It's a small amount. I mean, it can't be very large tension, but then again, it's a small nucleus.
It should also be sensitive to ATP. Mm-hmm. It's still puzzling that ATP doesn't really.
Well, it's only puzzling if they're playing a role, if the dynein is playing a role.
Any more of this.
Right.
But yeah. Polymerization is still.
That's what we think. So we think that the microtubule dynamics are the what's driving it.
Nick, just to go back to the Zim thing, but what's generally the, can you comment on modeling chromatin as an entangled set of DNA? I find it more questionable, right? I mean, chromatin is kind of separated condensed particles. They're not really entangled.
This yeast is known to have a pretty fluffy nucleus, right?
But they still have histones. There's two other sets of experiments that really point to chromosomes really behaving just like bare DNA in instances, for example, a linear response. So John Marco does a lot of pipette pulling on whole chromosomes that he's now doing mammalian cells, but before he was doing grasshopper chromosomes. And from his experiments, even though he keeps all the proteins on and then he can drive them off, he finds that he sees a small difference in, say, the magnitude of the power law that he gets from that, but not from the frequency dependence, the time dependence of the response function. And then there's the Dennis Disher experiments that I showed. Those are chromosomes that have many more proteins on it than yeast, and he still sees Zim-like behavior in the complex.
But for E. coli, it's very different, right? E. coli is our
I don't know about, are you talking about Suk Jun's experiments where he, I haven't looked at E. coli DNA at all. Yeah. I don't know why it would be stiffer.
You can label internal chromosomes and E. coli and do a biology and you find that it's essentially elastic.
Well, this data from Julie Theriot, she sees. No, she did mostly E. coli. It's just that she also did yeast. And she looks at DNA loci and the time dependence. So she sees the same power law for E. coli and yeast.
No, but one point is not going to tell you anything you need to.
I agree.
Point, right?
So that's also been done not by her. She didn't cite the work, but it's been done by a Swiss group. And if you look at, they don't do two-point correlations because it's a biology group, but they do plot mean square displacement, which is something. And they plot the relative displacement of those two points. And the power law looks the same.
I'm curious what experiments you're referring to, because it's correlated motion of two points?
Yes.
But how is it analyzed? How does that translate to a mechanical?
I just know vaguely that, yeah, I don't know, do you Paul Wiggins?
Yeah, but did they translate that to a mechanics measurement assuming thermal fluctuations?
I may want to have to look at the paper.
Yeah,
or the paper.
I'm not aware of that at all. Yeah.
I think they did this.
Yeah, then I
got dropped.
But it is important to note that. To your question, these are less condensed. This is not a.
They are indeed. That's true. But the Disher experiments on more condensed DNA see the same power law. It is puzzling, but maybe not so puzzling that the mechanics of DNA dominate over whatever the proteins are doing it.
But Disher's experiments were an interface, right? They were not dividing. Right?
He doesn't monitor what phase of the cell cycle it's in. I would say we don't know that for sure.
If you go back to your time scale,
he doesn't monitor it, which means they could be in any phase. Sorry.
I mean, just in terms of the polymer physics of what's going on, it was sort of, maybe I didn't understand where you were compared to. Are you in a reputation regime here? Is that?
Yes.
So obviously, though, if there's proteins, that's exactly what would be suppressed, right? If there's cross-linking protein binding that wouldn't.
Cross-linkers are one thing.
Okay.
But if you just have decorating DNA proteins,
just beads on a string.
It turns out to not change the rheology.
you think it would change the time scale or something because the effect of fiber.
It's really dominated by entanglements. So it is very, because it's in reptation. So you don't really have, you don't really have crosslinkers for DNA unless you have transcription machinery doing looping or something that, in a transient fashion. Sorry, what were you going to ask?
I would just think the time scales should be different than their DNA, just because it's condensed fiber, even if it wasn't. So taking the plot directly one of the other, even if it is a rotating polymer entangled solution.
It turns out that by these different, well, mine is indirect because it's modeled. John Marco's directly on single chromosomes, and Dennis Fischer's from the nuclei. The time scale dependence is the same in all three.
Yeah, but that approximate 1/2 exponent isn't in the rotation machine.
Oh, I see what you're asking.
Yeah. So, rotation.
So there's not really a true plateau, but you're thinking of up here.
I was thinking of the low frequency. I thought you said you were in the low frequency regime, and so I was thinking that your in vitro thing would be measuring in reputation dynamics in the low frequency regime, but that's not what is going on.
The crossover should be subcharacteristic time, right?
Yeah.
That's what I was getting at, the fiber size question.
But so the reputation regime is included in our frequency regime.
Okay.
And then down here, you're beyond reputation.
I would say maybe a little bit of the beginnings of reputation, but. Mm-hmm.
Some broad transition sometimes.
Yeah. Well, I think it's really interesting. Why does the DNA behave the same even when it's decorated by proteins? It's kind of surprising.
But of course, if you do that in your in vitro tag and throw some decoration.
That's what John Marco's done. Yeah.
Okay.
And it's changed very much.
What's the topic of the packet as well? Is it done faster?
I don't remember what his frequency regime is. I think he certainly gets most of this. I've left out the higher frequency that we get, but he definitely. Somebody should do it, yeah. Somebody should do it again. Somebody should do it using microrheology. Maybe we should. You're reviewing my grant? All right, so that's the end of that story. So I could tell you one of two things. One is the anaphase fluctuations or what we have done is an in vitro model with the DNA, but also some of the machines that add activity to the DNA. So I'm actually tempted to do that. Okay. So, because the other story is not really fleshed out yet either. Yeah, I was told I should stop at 11:45. Should I? Oh, after Tommy's talk, I was told that it's normal to go to 11:45. That's what people told me. Okay. If it's not the case, then I will stop in just a couple minutes. Okay, so I've jumped ahead, so I'm going to have to jump to the last slide. Just to give you a flavor. So in this in vitro system, the DNA has been extracted from the cell, or we're just doing it with lambda DNA for the moment. So you have pure DNA plus this enzyme, topoisomerase, that does double strand passage in the cell. So it's not a process of enzyme. It just does one cycle, and then it's done. So this is like a minimal model for activity. So it's the simplest system you can have and have activity. This would be. So we're looking at it from that standpoint. So the physical picture is you basically have a phantom network. It's different from worm-like micelles, though, because the filaments can't change their length dynamically. They're always the same length. The strand breakage and reformation is always completely correlated. So it's quite different from worm-like micelles. And we again do bead rheology, microrheology in this system. And here I'm showing the time dependence of that you see for the fluctuations. So it does a duplex strand passage. So topoisomerase 2 takes two strands of DNA and passes them. So imagine my arm is a duplex DNA, and it passes an entire duplex DNA through another. Right. It's a dimer. So each monomer of the dimer breaks one of the two strands of the duplex DNA and keeps the other strand intact there. Sorry, keeps the ends intact at certain tyrosine residues on the protein. It uses ATP, although topoisomerase 1, which just does single-strand passage to relieve torsional stress, for example, doesn't require ATP. So this enzyme does, which is this, the energy required to create that temporary bond is completely neutral. So it doesn't, it's not obvious why it requires ATP. So this enzyme is required in late anaphase. It's been shown very clearly in yeast. So when the cells need to segregate the chromosomes and do that final stage of pulling of large scale transport of the genetic material, they need this enzyme. And if they don't have it, it stops at that point. And it's been shown most clearly in yeast because the genetics are so easy to do.
Your statement that it's not obvious why it requires ATP is just that the state before and the state after
are neutral.
Same. So it's only a barrier crossing.
Right.
It's an infinite barrier crossing which is made finite by the presence of the cell.
Right. But there's a directionality requirement in the cell. So that's one of the puzzles about this.
Yeah.
So locally, this enzyme shouldn't know that it's relaxing the DNA globally. So just to give you a
just the mere fact that ATP is involved presumably means that detailed balance and whatever, you know, would be happening there would be broken.
Okay. So this is the DNA rheology without the enzyme there, or with the enzyme there but no ATP. And this is in frequency space, so these are the fluctuations of hundreds of beats plotted together. When you add the enzyme and add ATP, we do the experiment in such a way that we acquire the multiparticle tracking data in windows. So over time, the ATP is getting exhausted by the enzyme. So there's activity, and then there's less activity, and then there's less activity, and so on, until there's no activity at all. So the system goes from active to passive while we're monitoring it. And you can see that it sort of asymptotically reaches this. This would be presumably thermal, or it's converging to thermal.
So what is the numbers there? 10.5?
Those in microns.
Oh,
in minutes. Right.
No, those are minutes.
These are minutes, right. So in 2 hours for this concentration. And the system is, there's more than enough enzymes for every DNA entanglement, and there's more than enough ATP initially for every enzyme. So it's, the entanglements are saturated with enzyme, and the enzyme saturated with ATP here.
But it's running out of it.
So that's the thermal, that's the non-thermal to thermal behavior. Right. Well, I should stop, should I? I don't have something definitive yet, but I can show you something tantalizing.
Okay.
So, you know, Tom Lubensky's idea is that, or that is in the 2003 paper with Andy Lau, that you can group the stress fluctuations into this parameter. And measure, if you measure the fluctuations, if this is passive, if you just have thermal behavior, then the fluctuations are coupled to the viscous modulus. And you'll see a frequency dependence that's completely set by the rheology, the viscous modulus as well as the complex modulus. If you have active fluctuations, then as we talked about before, you basically have the stress spectrum divided by the modulus squared. So it suggests that if you measure this and somehow measure this, you can get this. So we're doing active microrheology to drive a bead to get this, to get the response of the material. If it were pushed out of equilibrium, and we measure this, and the idea is to be able to extract what's the force spectrum. But the reason I don't have definitive data right now is that our active microrheology experiment, we're only accessing frequencies from 1 to 100 hertz, so it's fast, and our data is lower frequencies. So we only have overlap in this region. So that's what we're working on right now, and that's why I don't have definitive data. So I don't know whether the rheology is changing during this. One interpretation would be that it's the denominator that's changing, because this enzyme is in there and it's making it go from more fluid to less fluid. So the change in the frequency dependence of this guy is purely due to that.
More
fluid. Starting out more fluid and then going to less fluid. More fluid than passive. It makes it more fluid than if it weren't there.
There is stress relaxation added by this enzyme.
Right. Oh, I didn't mean more fluid like in the response. I meant you see some large scale flow. Or
is that a step response?
No.
Then you can wait a long time.
Well, that's a good idea. Just like our microrheology experiment.
Yeah.
Cheap and dirty. Yeah, we should do that. Good idea. So we don't know this. So one other thing that's tantalizing, maybe it's interesting, is if the rheology weren't changing, so just bear with me for a moment because we don't have the data yet, then and what you're seeing in the spectrum is purely the active fluctuations, then that's what I'm going to show you. If we could interpret the data like that, and what it's converging to here is just telling us the modulus itself. And and if that's the case, then I should be able to subtract off that thermal spectrum, because what we're seeing all the time in the previous spectrum would be active plus thermal. So this would be active plus thermal, less of the active plus thermal, and this would be purely thermal. So the difference between those two is what I'm showing in this plot. Again, we don't know yet, but this would be the interpretation if the rheology is not changing. And so what's interesting, just the only thing I wanted to show you with this that's sort of tantalizing, is that as the activity decreases, we just see the same power law. If you subtract off that long time spectrum, and it's very close to 1 over F frequency dependence. So that's could be interesting, or could be that the rheology is changing the whole time, and we don't have that. So there's no model to predict this yet at all either. It could be that this enzyme is stirring, and that's the frequency dependence that you get from stirring, something like that.
You also would expect the time dependence in the cutting. It has a tunnel.
Right?
You expect a kink in this curve at some point.
It could be somewhere out here.
Some distribution, right?
Yeah. Okay, so I want to finish up there before I'm too much over time. Thank you.
With TOGO2, is much known about ATP-depleted case. It has ATP-depleted case, and that's some sort of later state where it might bind to two DNA molecules but not pass through.
Yes, so it
actually across
it. It turns out that it in the Rieger state, it will initially have two strands, and then so where it uses ATP is to close the gate when the second strand comes in. So if it doesn't have ATP, or if it runs out of ATP, it will just passively release that strand that came in, and it might hang on to one strand, but it will stochastically release that second strand. So there's a temporary crosslink.
It'll sometimes bind it.
Yes. Yeah.
Transient cross.
Yeah. Yes.
It's a little intriguing that this does seem to all be consistent with the single power law. It's a little hard to see that would happen if it's the rheology that's changing.
Yeah.
Tough to say so far.
Yeah.
Does a number on the y-axis make any sense? For example, you say let's explore a fluctuation. You just take one engine and one regulator and you bind, and you lose the force and you lose the binding rate, that gives this number, or?
So what does have a meaning, first of all, I wanted to show this is the spectrum that I subtracted off, which I called the thermal spectrum. So the frequency dependence is quite different, and also it's of about the same order as the thermal. In this case, the activity seems to be about the same order, which we already knew. For the rest of your question, what was the rest of your question?
Just like
a model.
Fluctuates is because something is binding and then binding.
It's not clear what the topoisomerase would do in terms of moving the bead, but how would it move the bead?
What I have done is if you integrate under this spectrum, then you should get a power dissipated per bead. And it makes sense. It makes sense in that sense, like it's of the right order of magnitude. Okay, thank you again for your attention. Thanks.